And not only in these very important respects, but even in respects less important, in Tibetan Buddhism you find a combination, a synthesis, if you like, of organization and freedom. Usually in the West we find these two are antithetical. The more organization, the less freedom. The more freedom, the less organization. They don't go together. But not with regard to traditional Tibetan Buddhism. In Tibetan Buddhism, you had the biggest monasteries in the world. Even those of Mount Athos are insignificant in comparison. Just think, whole monastic towns, whole monastic cities. Just think, in Ganden, 3,000 monks. In Depung, 5,000. In Serra, 7,000. Just think of that. And at the time of the new year in Lhasa, for one whole month, when the monks take over the administration, 30,000 monks inhabiting the city of Lhasa. So just think of that. You've got the biggest monasteries in the world, or had, in Tibet. At the same time, in Tibet you find the loneliest, the most isolated hermitages. You can find monasteries with thousands of monks, monastic cities, but also you can go miles, hundreds of miles, way out into the wilderness, and you can find little caves, little shacks, little temples with just one solitary hermit living. You find this too, and it's not infrequent. So here again you get this sort of balance, this sort of synthesis. In a way, Tibetan Buddhism was the most monasticized, if one can use that expression, in the world. You found monks everywhere. Just imagine if you were in London and you walked down Oxford Street and every other person you met was a monk. Well, this is what it was like in Lhasa in the old days. Wherever you went, monks, nothing but monks. But at the same time, you might think, well, they were monk-dominated, or monk-ridden even. Or you may think there was too much monk-craft, and so on. But no. Even though you get so many monks in Tibet, a higher percentage of monks to the population than anywhere else in the world, at the same time, despite this highly developed monasticism, one has a full participation by the laity in the spiritual life. No one thinks that you have to be a monk in order to practice the religion. This is the wonderful thing about it. In Theravada countries, in Ceylon and Burma, they tend to think that you can't be a real Buddhist unless you become a monk. But in Tibet, though they've got so many monks, they never think this. In fact, amongst the Nyingma Pas, at least one may say, the laity, including the lay lamas, they practically run the show. They have very, very few monks in comparison. So this is a sort of contradiction almost. But really it's a synthesis. You get overwhelming monasticism on the one hand, but full spiritual participation by the laity on the other. And then again, one may say, to generalize even more, Tibetan Buddhists as a whole have their head way up in the clouds. Way up in the clouds. But their feet are firmly on the ground. Firmly on the ground. The Tibetan Buddhists, after all, have, or try to follow, the sublimest and most rarefied of all spiritual ideals, that of the Bodhisattva. This sort of ideal is, I was going to say, common talk, but certainly current coin in Tibet. Everyone knows this, everyone appreciates this, and to some extent tries to follow it. The ideal of the one who doesn't care for his own individual salvation, but who devotes himself to the spiritual well-being of the whole human race, regardless of the cost to himself. So this is their ideal. Something very high, something very sublime, something very rarefied. But at the same time, the Tibetan is intensely practical. This is one of the things which struck me about the Tibetans as compared with the Indians. I'm sorry to have to say this, but the Indians are very often not very practical people. They're just a little bit woolly, but not so the Tibetans. The Tibetans are very, very practical people indeed. And I've seen myself a number of times Tibetans coming down from Tibet, never having seen a motor car before. But 6 months later, they're experienced motor mechanics. And they're very good at this sort of thing. They're very practical. They like to understand how things work, how they're put together, how they're taken apart, how they go, what makes them go, how they function. They're very, very good at this indeed. They're very, very practical about all affairs of life, whether it's food or whether it's clothing or building or earning money, making money, engaging in trade, business. They're very, very practical people. I might go so far as to say that there's nothing mystic, nothing occult about the Tibetans in the woolly sense of those terms at all. In this country, only too often, at least in the past, people tended to think of the Tibetans as wonderful, sort of mystical, occult figures, living behind the Himalayas in an aura of mystery, surrounded by all sorts of miracles and wonderful happenings. And the idea that the Tibetan never thought of eating or drinking or making money, this was a sort of blasphemy. Especially among some occult circles in this country, they speak of the masters beyond the Himalaya, and you gather that they were always immersed in meditation, and no one thought of anything except religion, and so on and so forth. But this is not really like the Tibetans at all. They are mystical in the true sense. They are occultists in the true sense. They do have their heads up in the clouds spiritually, but as I said, their feet are firmly planted on the earth. And this is perhaps something which we too might emulate.